It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The nonprofit hospital chain Ascension Wisconsin plans to outsource staffing of its intensive care units to Team Health. That's a national private equity-backed firm based in Knoxville, Tennessee.
That's raised some concerns about exactly what kind of medical personnel will be on hand and available to deal with medical emergencies. Ascension operates multiple hospitals in Wisconsin, especially in the Milwaukee metropolitan area.
The director of the Center for the Business of Health at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Zoe Kernodle, told WPR that this is becoming more common across the U.S. as hospitals face significant funding challenges and cuts from the federal government.
Outsourcing clinical staff is certainly the easiest way to lighten expenses.
Sarah Volpenhayn is a healthcare reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and reported on this story this week. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, give us the basics here. What is Ascension moving from and to when it comes to staffing for this this important part of their services?
Yeah, so currently Ascension Wisconsin contracts with a number of local physician groups. And these groups are made up of critical care providers, so critical care doctors, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and they are the doctors and mid-level providers that staff the ICUs at Ascension Wisconsin hospitals. One of the groups, for example, is Midwest Critical Care, which is a small local group of physicians and mid-level practitioners specialized in this type of medicine and critical care.
And what do we know about this Team Health, a private equity-backed firm, and the kind of services they've provided elsewhere in the country?
Yeah, so like you said at the top of the show, Ascension Wisconsin is switching from these local groups to Team Health. They are a national physician staffing company, and they have thousands of physicians who are either employed or contracted with them or their affiliates, and they provide staffing at hospitals all across the country. This could be not only in intensive care units, but also emergency departments, other units or departments in the hospital or clinics. And what we know about this company is that back in 2017, it was acquired by Blackstone. This is a major private equity firm. So it is a private equity backed company. And it also has a bit of a spotty track record in terms of concerns about staffing levels at hospitals where its physicians are providing staffing. And it's also been sued quite a few times in court over allegations that it engages in fraudulent billing.
People might hear, okay, well, it's one group of doctors, now it's another group of doctors. What's the big deal? But a lot of people you talked about and a lot of signs in the plan suggest that part of this change means there'll be fewer doctors or different kinds of doctors available. What kind of things, from what you're seeing in this plan, will this mean for what a patient might see in an intensive care unit?
Yeah, that's a great question. So my reporting found that Team Health plans to cut physician staffing at hospital ICUs, part of Ascension Wisconsin. And the physicians who I spoke with, who talked with me on the condition of anonymity because they are afraid of retaliation, they said that these cuts would be to dangerous levels and it would mean fewer critical care providers on ICU floors or no critical care provider at all in some of the smaller hospitals. So some of these smaller hospitals would move to what's called an electronic ICU for part or all of the day. And that's where no critical care physician would be physically present, but would be available virtually.
What kind of statements has Ascension Wisconsin made about these changes, either to you or just in public statements?
Yeah. So when we reached out to Ascension Wisconsin to ask about this, they did send us a statement. They wanted to make clear that at these hospitals, physicians would be present or clinicians would be present. What I tried to clarify is whether these physicians would in any cases be critical care physicians. And, the physicians who are present might be some different type of doctor who isn't specialized necessarily in critical care. The other thing that Ascension Wisconsin wanted to emphasize was that there would be at all of these hospitals 24/7 access to critical care clinicians. When I tried to clarify whether that access would be entirely virtual at some sites, they did not provide any clarification about that. But also Ascension Wisconsin wanted to say that they are making this change to better align staffing and resources to match the acuity level of their patients at the hospitals they treat. And that's a direct quote from the statement that they provided.
Yeah, just to clarify, those statements you made took some parsing. It seems like it could mean, well, there's always a doctor available in intensive care, but that might, as you say, not be a critical care doctor under that statement. There will always be a critical care doctor available, but not necessarily in person. So it could be, hey, I'm a normal kind of doctor. I may not have a lot of background in critical care, and I'm consulting my critical care colleague who's, what, on a Zoom call or something like that. That could match the statements you got from Ascension.
That's right, yes. And the doctors who I spoke with were very concerned about this. It would mean a change in the level of services that are provided, and they're worried that it's going to lead to higher levels of complications and potentially even deaths at some of these hospitals where maybe not the right doctor is seeing a patient who is critically ill and, in need of some really serious medical intervention. One of the nurses who I spoke with told me that she wasn't exactly sure how the EICUs would work. That's Ascension Wisconsin is still in the process of determining its ICU staffing plan. The nurse who I spoke with said that in her past experience, it might be an offsite critical care physician who has remote access to cameras in EICU rooms that would allow the physician to monitor patients and their vital signs in real time. And then in a medical emergency, that offsite physician could try to help walk through an onsite doctor what to do. But she emphasized to me, this nurse, that, that critical care doctor would not be physically present to perform a potentially life-saving procedure that maybe a doctor specialized in a different kind of medicine might not know how to do or not be very practiced in doing.
Talking to Sarah Volpenhayn, healthcare reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Ascension Wisconsin hospitals making changes to their intensive care staffing. Speaking of nurses, WPR heard from Connie Smith, president of the Wisconsin Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals, worried about what could happen in a situation you just laid out there, a crisis situation. Here's a listen.
They're the ones that are, taken into court. Our nurses are licensed professionals, but yet they're not licensed to be scapegoats for a cheaper version of physician care.
Did you hear those kind of concerns, Sarah, from the different healthcare workers you talked to that, hey, I might be left holding the bag here because of these changes?
Yes, I did hear that concern. I think there was a lot of concern about the patients as well. And I think a lot of the people I spoke with said that, local doctors will go above and beyond a lot of the time. They're on call in the middle of the night at a lot of these hospitals to come in for any kind of emergency that might be happening. And if there's no critical care physician present, they worry about what might happen to the level of patient care.
Now, you mentioned there's a local staffing group, Midwest Critical Care, among others, who have been staffing the ICUs. What happens to the physicians there? Do they have an opportunity to sign up with Team Health? Are they on the unemployment line? What happens to the people who've been providing these services?
Yeah, so from my understanding, Team Health is trying to recruit Midwest critical care physicians and other physicians locally who might be picking up some kind of part-time contract. My understanding is that few physicians, if any, part of that Midwest Critical Care Group have expressed interest or have signed on, I should say, to to working with Team Health. But it's unclear at this time exactly who the physicians will be who are staffing the ICUs on September 1st when this change takes effect or is scheduled to take effect. And I think that's a big concern for a lot of the folks I talked with is it's unclear whether these physicians who are coming in will have skills necessary in some of the specialized ICUs, for example, at Columbia St. Mary's in Milwaukee, which has a, you know, burn ICU that sees patients with severe burns. And then there's other specialized, you know, ICUs for cardiac patients, patients who are out of major surgery. There's a lot of unknowns right now about who exactly is going to be coming in on September 1st.
And just briefly, Sarah, September 1st, that's 2 weeks away. What are you watching for as this transition happens?
Yeah, I think I'm watching for exactly those questions. What exactly happens on September 1? Who are the folks who are going to be coming in and how this transition is going to take place once that change goes into effect?
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks so much.
That's Sarah Volpenhayn, healthcare reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at upcoming changes to intensive care staffing in Ascension, Wisconsin hospitals and questions about the kinds of physicians available in person for various kinds of emergency services.
Coming up, the state's top public defender struggles to fill vacant jobs and recruits out of state.
We are not able to fill our need here at the public defender by just looking to our local in-state law schools and hiring law students that graduate from there.
A check on the court system for people who can't afford an attorney. That's next from WPR News.
Here it's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The new state budget is the second in a row to increase pay for public defenders. It also added new prosecutors in nearly two dozen counties and legal support staff, including six paralegals in the Wisconsin State Public Defender's Office.
But Wisconsin's court system has long faced staffing challenges and case backlogs. According to data from the Wisconsin court system, only around half of all criminal cases statewide are resolved within 6 months.
Wisconsin's top public defender says our state isn't producing enough attorneys to meet demand, and she's recruiting out of state to try to help staff up her office. So will recent pay increases and additional legal staff and paralegals have an impact for people without the means to afford an attorney? We're joined by the state's public defender, Jennifer Bias, to discuss these issues of staffing and caseload. Jennifer, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
The new state budget signed last month by Governor Evers, it's set to increase the pay of public defenders and district attorneys in each of the next 2 years. How significant are these raises on the work you do?
The raises are very significant. Every 2 years, prosecutors and public defenders approach the state legislature to ask for merit pay increases. It's an unusual process for this group of state employees. And we are always thankful and extremely happy when we come through the process, having been allocated the resources for pay that are very, very necessary and that serve to keep our public defenders and prosecutors employed.
And, you know, the state, with adding some support in the administrative staff area, some paralegals, How does that impact your work and your ability to take on these cases?
Well, adding support professionals to the public defender agency at this time is extremely critical. We asked for over 50 positions in the state budget, and we were given 12. Mm-hmm. We received paralegals, investigators, clericals, et cetera, and we're thankful for the positions that we did receive, but our need is much greater than the number that we were provided. Paralegals and investigators and social workers assist our lawyers in doing the very, very difficult work and challenging work that they must engage in. The public defender serves every single county in the state of Wisconsin. However, we don't have an office in every single county. And that requires our staff to have to drive from county to county to visit with folks in jails and courtrooms. So it's extremely important to have support help by professionals who know the work and are dedicated and committed. Our staff, they're just absolutely wonderful, but we're just short. And this budget provided us with a little more in terms of getting to where we need to be. But again, our need is greater than the number of positions that we received in this past budget.
So in terms of being short, can you talk about the workload that your staff is taking on and what the implications are to people who are waiting for a public defender to take their case?
Yeah, the workloads are very heavy. Our lawyers are assigned workload. They handle all of the cases that they can ethically and competently handle. And that's a very high number of clients. Those clients have a high number of needs. Our public defender clients don't come with insurance policies so that they can receive treatment or other resources that can be used in their defense. So the public defender attorneys and our staff are all looking for the resources to be able to provide the defense that that client needs. Unfortunately, caseloads are high and public defenders don't determine our workload. Prosecutors do. And although crime has been down in our state for years, charging seems to be up and continuing to go up. And we struggle to provide attorney representation for each and every one of those clients. So we are struggling to keep up with the demand that is being created and put on our legal system to provide representation for those who qualify financially for our services.
So if you're saying there is a shortage of lawyers, where do you look to bring in new recruits, new attorneys? What is recruitment like?
Yeah, recruitment is very challenging. Of course, we look to the University of Wisconsin Law School, Marquette University Law School. But in for many years now, we have been looking out of state. We certainly look to our neighboring states of Minnesota. We have a very nice program for an internship that is called the SAICS Fellowship. They provide us with a few attorneys every year, and those students become staff in our office. And after they are trained for about 9 months or so, they take the bar examination, and they typically are assigned to work in one of our offices. It is important to know, I think, that we are not able to fill our need here at the public defender by just looking to our local in-state law schools and hiring law students that graduate from there. We absolutely have to go outside of the state. And right now, as we sit here, I have about 30 vacancies in public defender offices across the state of Wisconsin.
When you look at caseloads, I want to turn to bail jumping. You have said that the growth in charges for bail jumping and these pretrial conditions has been a great overreach. What effect has this increase had on suspects and on case workload?
You know, we feel that it has had a tremendous increase. We've looked at charging practices across the state of Wisconsin and noticed that the charging practices are highly disparate. Some prosecutors charge a lot of bail jumpings, like more than 200 to a single individual for a course of conduct in one day, to other prosecutors that don't charge bail jumping at all, or they wait until the case is over to make a determination about what's appropriate. When a number of bail jumping charges are alleged, we have a very difficult time finding defense lawyers to represent those individuals. And many of them sit in our jails for months and months and months, waiting for a lawyer willing to take on their matters. Wisconsin has a bail jumping statute that is out of line with our neighboring states and other states across the United States. And I'd like to see us be a lot more in line with and frankly, treating our residents and the folks in Wisconsin who come into the system consistently in a fair way as they are in other states. I think the words bail jump are a bit of a misnomer. And if we could be a little bit more consistent, it would be helpful to the criminal legal system. You know, your question is a great one because it also, you know, it's not just bail jumping, but, you know, we are fast approaching a time when we are not going to be able to, we're already there, I think. We can't afford the criminal legal system to continue to operate in the direction that it's been going for the last few years. We can't charge every single crime that's on the books. We really need to make some decisions about evidence-based charging, what is going to be effective, how can we be charging as much as is going through our court system, as many types of offenses as are being charged out in our court system, when the crime statistics clearly indicate that crime is down in our state and in our nation. So there's a bit of a disconnect there. And I'd like to see also our charging be more in line with what the taxpayers expect the results to be from the criminal legal system and the outcomes.
Can you explain that a little more? What do you mean there?
Well, the outcomes, we expect that folks would be rehabilitated. And so going into custody with law enforcement, then being charged by a prosecutor, being defended, perhaps being found guilty or not. Maybe there's an alternative program that's available that would get restitution for a victim. A victim might be satisfied with restitution in a certain kind of case, and incarceration wouldn't be necessary. The short end of this, you know, is this. Wisconsin is at the highest point of incarcerating its citizens as compared to other states and compared to the United States. I've seen statistics where we outpace many other states much larger in size than Wisconsin. I think that's an incredible tax burden, and you know, it should be pulled back.
And it sounds like, Jennifer, that salary bumps alone, expanded staffing, can't solve what your office is experiencing in the case workloads.
No, the salary bumps, the additional positions, adding prosecutors, more prosecutors, that means you need to add more public defenders, but then you also need to add judges. We're now talking about tearing down prisons and building new prisons. I mean, we've got an entire system that needs to have a conversation about where we're headed financially.
Jennifer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Bias is Wisconsin's state public defender. She was appointed by Governor Evers in June of last year. Previously, she served as the state public defender's trial division director. For another perspective on the state's shortage of lawyers, return to Megan Lee. She's the chair of the State Bar of Wisconsin Legal Assistance Committee and is with the federally funded nonprofit law firm Judicare Legal Aid. She starts by explaining the need for services around the state.
You know, we specifically as a legal aid provider, know that there are so many people who need help with legal cases, whether that's criminal, as you know, the prior guest mentioned, or civil, which is a lot of other legal issues that have a lot of life-changing impacts. So, you know, whether someone has a place to live, they're able to get out of an abusive situation, if they are able to maintain benefits that they've earned. So thinking about, you know, the overwhelming need for legal help and the absolutely underwhelming kind of ability for the state to provide that. So I think specifically about, you know, the rural shortages that we see across the state, you know, it's difficult to find attorneys, you know, to take pro bono cases, even in Madison and Milwaukee. So if you kind of zoom out and look at the remainder of the state where there are already shortages of attorneys, there's already counties with so few attorneys, that it's just not kind of realistic for everyone who needs an attorney to be able to get one, even if they could afford it.
Judicare Legal Aid is a federally funded nonprofit law firm. Is your organization feeling any effects of federal funding cuts?
In a way, yes. So not necessarily direct losses of funding yet. We are, you know, keeping an eye on the Legal Services Corporation funding. That has been kind of a top issue of, of the day a little bit for us, because we are one of two Legal Services Corporation funded organizations in the state. And that funding makes up about a third of our budgets. So losing that funding could have, you know, really devastating impacts on our organizations. But beyond that, you know, we've seen both kind of grant programs that used have existed in the past no longer existing, or, you know, grant programs we applied for that have been eliminated. So in that way, you know, concerns about losing even opportunities to seek funding, in addition to the additional strings that are coming attached to a lot of funding now, specifically related to executive orders and kind of limitations on language.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, too, many communities have been grappling with cuts to VOCA, the Victims of Crime Act funding. Has that made an impact at all?
Absolutely. Judicare used to work with Legal Action of Wisconsin, our southern counterpart, to staff statewide victims' rights and elder rights projects. Those were both VOCA funded, and because of VOCA cuts, our projects basically disappeared. We get a very limited amount of VOCA funding through the state, and that is put towards representing victims of primarily domestic abuse, trying to kind of leave those abusive situations. But it changed the face of the work that we were able to do, unfortunately.
I wonder, too, with the state grappling with positions that are vacant in the Office of Public Defender, what impact does that have on Judicare Legal Fund as well when the state public defender's office is also under immense workload?
I think some of our clients are also kind of impacted by the criminal legal system, whether that's directly by having, you know, cases against them, or being a victim of a crime that, you know, there's an open case on, or having some sort of family connection. The delays are incredibly traumatizing, you know, especially I used to do victims' rights work. So seeing how stressful it is for a victim to sit and wait and wait and wait for a case to move forward, especially when, you know, there's been so much trauma there, and having the uncertainty and the unknown for years is incredibly taxing. And, you know, we've made requests before to try to get private attorneys appointed for, you know, cases where the defendant didn't have a public defender yet, and it was causing delays in the case. But also our clients who, you know, maybe have issues that have caused them to, you know, get arrested or end up in the carceral system. So thinking about what can we do to help in those situations? And, you know, while there is this constitutional guarantee for an attorney in criminal cases, even then, there are still difficulties with people accessing legal help. So in cases where it's a civil matter, there's no constitutional guarantee. So it's really dependent upon funding sources to provide any sort of guidance in cases that really still have a lot of life-changing impacts for people.
Megan, as we close, how could more lawyers, new lawyers, go into nonprofit legal work? Because in a sense, it is a calling.
The biggest thing is to look for any organizations that help, but also be open. You know, nonprofit work can be incredibly rewarding and supportive. You know, we have a lot of structures in place to try to provide mentorship and professional development and all of that, because we have to build skills very quickly when there's a lot of turnover. So building those skills, getting people ready to go to court and be practicing attorneys so that we can help our clients right away and, you know, be able to limit, you know, the decrease in services when we have someone new starting.
Megan, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Megan Lee is a member of the State Bar of Wisconsin Legal Assistance Committee and Communications and Development Director for Judicare Legal Aid. Earlier, we heard from Wisconsin's State Public Defender Jennifer Bias with an update on staffing challenges and how to meet the needs of indigent cases.
Coming up, find out how a kid from Wanakee became a legendary pilot landing on glaciers in Alaska.
And he got hooked up with a couple of barnstormers that, in exchange for him being a mechanic for him, that he would get flying lessons. And from there, it just kind of took off.
That's next on Wisconsin Today.
This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about music just in time for this weekend's Milwaukee Irish Fest.
Irish music sessions regularly pop up in pubs and restaurants across Wisconsin. These are generally informal gatherings where tin whistlers, fiddlers, and accordionists play traditional Irish tunes. Writer Nancy Jorgensen of Waukesha tells us more about her growing love of these sessions.
On a Tuesday evening, I yank open the back door to House of Guinness, Waukesha, Wisconsin's popular Irish pub. I allow my eyes to adjust and notice the quiet. That won't last long. The narrow space with its elongated bar top reminds me of a New York City pub. A few regulars perch at the rail, facing the bartender who lifts a hand as I walk in. Next to expansive street-side windows, I choose a chair and unpack my gear. An iPad for reading music, a melodica for playing, and money for a stout. I've only participated in this Irish session a few times, so I probably won't know the songs. My instrument is unconventional, and I don't usually drink while performing. I wonder how this evening will go. The medley of musicians changes week to week. Some new faces peer curiously at my instrument. "What is that?" they say. I lift my 1.5-pound melodica to show 37 black and white keys. I blow through its plastic tube and press one of the keys, allowing my breath to activate a reed. Ta-da! Sound! Before I can explain more, Patrick, the leader, launches into a tune and the musicians jump in. Violins scratching, mandolins plucking, and a button box squeezing, all on melody. Guitarists play chords and a percussionist beats the baran, an Irish hand drum. The tempo is quick. My fingers stumble and I miss some notes. But when my notes are correct, the melodica blends with the strings and sounds similar to the button box. My daughter and her friend, both violinists, are also new to this group and miss a few sharps and flats, but they quickly master the key signature as their fingers dance across the strings. The music score, controlled by Patrick, appears automatically on my iPad. True Irish sessions don't use printed notes, but rely on an oral tradition. Players learn by ear and remember the tunes. I'm grateful we use a score because I don't memorize easily. Typically, the first run-through of a tune is rocky, but we repeat each song multiple times, and by the third round, our ensemble is clean and confident. Some of my daughter's friends sit at the bar, and when we play a jig, they clap and hoot, and soon others do the same. A little girl wanders close to me and dances. A few patrons record iPhone videos. Meanwhile, I lose myself in the music, surfing scales and arpeggios, riding the musical wave as it dips and crests. For 3 hours we play. There are no breaks. Additional players wander in, and the circle grows to three deep. Throughout the night, I field melodica questions. Do you get winded? It's more like breathing than blowing, I say. Does it drip? There's a moisture vent on the side. My leg gets damp. How many octaves can you play? Three. As the clock nears 9 p.m., Patrick seems to choose familiar songs. The musicians play every note right, guitars lock into a groove, and out of nowhere, the men sing along on select phrases. But my neck is stiff, my legs need to walk, and my brain begs for a break. As I start to pack up, others settle in. I've heard they shift from Irish to old time or folk and stay another few hours. This weekly group offered me a warm Wisconsin welcome. They accepted my unconventional melodica and tolerated my shallow knowledge of Irish music. Despite the Guinness, I played mostly right notes, and I enjoyed the camaraderie of a group instead of practicing at home alone. As I tip my pint to catch the last drop, Patrick grins. See you next week? The din diminishes as the group dwindles. I deposit my glass on the bar top, meander to the back, and yank open the door. The sky is dark. I notice the quiet.
Writer Nancy Jorgensen brought us that story on an Irish music session in Waukesha. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
In 1902, the year before the Wright brothers first got their plane in the air, legendary Bush pilot Robert Campbell Reeve was born in Wanakee, Wisconsin.
Reeve became a pioneer in the field of aviation, mastering the dangerous practice of glacier flying, shuttling supplies and people to and from the most remote parts of the Alaskan wilderness by taking off and landing on glaciers high in the mountains.
It all began in Wisconsin. After joining the Army at the age of 15, Reeve started at the UW Law School in 1922. But he and his friends spent all their spare time in an airfield near the university.
Here he is talking about his first flying lessons with journalist Sandy Jensen in 1976.
Well, about that time, there was a couple old barnstormers around there named Cash Chamberlain and Walt Bullock, and probably an old Northwest Airlines pilot just retired. And they had a Jenny out of Madison on there. And I used to go out there, and whenever I could spare up a few dollars or get a ride and get a few minutes instruction.
He was expelled for spending more time at the airfield than with his studies. He left Wisconsin to explore the world, crashing planes and stowing away on ships to eventually end up in Alaska, where he'd become an aviation legend and later establish an airline, Reeve Aleutian Airways.
He was eventually inducted into the National Aviation Hall of Fame and the International Aerospace Hall of Fame.
Reeve's son, David, followed his father's tracks back to Wisconsin, becoming CEO of Milwaukee-based Skyway Airlines and senior vice president of Midwest Airlines. David joins us now for a look at his father's legacy. David, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Oh, you're welcome, Rob. I'm privileged to be here.
Now, your dad, as I understand, was born the year before the Wright brothers' first flight. He was an early adopter of airplanes. What inspired his interest in flying?
Well, he always said that he was born in a year that the weather was so bad, not a single airplane got off the ground. It was one of his favorite things that he would say. But I don't know what particularly attracted him to aviation, but it was very early. I mean, he started flying in the 1920s when there was more barnstorming than anything else. And he got hooked up with a couple of barnstormers that, in exchange for him being a mechanic for him, that he would get flying lessons. And from there, it just kind of took off. He was in all the early phases of aviation. You know, he worked for the early Pan Am, Pan Agra, which was a South American division of Pan American World Airways, and ended up in Alaska in 1932.
Just looking at the whole story, I mean, he bops over to Asia for a while. He's flying these routes in South America. He stows away on a ship to make his way to Alaska. Your dad, hearing the story anyway, your dad seems like this larger-than-life character. I don't know why there aren't movies made about him. Can you talk about your dad's spirit of adventure?
Well, looking at his background, which you just described, he was a wanderer. He used to say he was more a vagabond and a wanderer than anything else. And I think he just had a curiosity. I mean, he joined the Army in World War I when he was 15 years old. And never changed after that. I mean, he was always doing something different than what other people were doing. He had a wide area of interest in things. And I think aviation, because it was so new, may have been one of the things that attracted him to it.
David, I want to take things back to Wisconsin a little bit. And we talked a little about the origins of your dad's interest in airlines. Now, an interesting story. He got so interested in flying that he didn't quite complete college. Could you share that story with us?
Well, I think to hear him tell it, the only thing he was learning in college was how to make bathtub gin. And so he was an adventurous guy. And I think college kind of tied him down and he didn't like that. And so he decided to strike out and ended up in the aviation business.
What brought him to Alaska, this in many ways a frontier in American history, to try to be a pilot there?
Well, his story is he was flying the Andes, or Pan Am, Pan Agra, forerunner of Pan Am. And he claims he wrecked one of their airplanes and he wanted to beat him. He didn't want to be fired, so he decided it was time to leave and head back to the States. So he took his savings, put it in the stock market in 1929, lost it all. And that's where next thing you know, he found himself on a freighter going to Alaska as a stowaway. When he got to Alaska, they landed at Valdez, and he immediately saw a broken up Eagle Rock biplane. And he went to the owner of the wrecked airplane and says, "I'll fix it up if you let me rent it from you for $1 an hour, or something like that. And that's when he started flying in Alaska.
He's going to remote places, and it seems like he quickly develops this specialty, this reputation. This is a guy who can land on glaciers and snow and just very difficult conditions. Tell us a little bit about the challenge with the technology of the time and making those kind of landings and takeoffs.
Well, the thing that he did that was special was you could land on skis in the wintertime because there was snow on the ground, but he was servicing mines on glaciers and areas like that were covered with snow in the summertime. So how do you take off from land? And at that time, they didn't have convertible wheel-ski combinations. How do you take off from land and then go up and service these mines and other things on glaciers? So he was pretty innovative. He designed a set of skis, which were basically for the landing on the glaciers. But in Valdez, there's mud flats because on low tide, there was mud was exposed. So he'd throw some water in front of his skis and take off on the mud flats because they were slick enough, and then he could go up and land on the glaciers and return. And that's what he really became well known for was the ability to service the high mountain areas summer and winter.
We're talking to David Reeve, formerly with Skyway Airlines based in Milwaukee and Midwest Airlines, talking about his father, legendary Wisconsin origin anyway, glacier and bush pilot Robert Campbell Reeve, Bob Reeve, a legend in Alaska. We found an archival interview with your dad. This is Ruth Briggs talking to him on the radio station KNIK in Alaska in 1961. She asked him about the dangers he faced while glacier flying.
Oh, sure. I wouldn't hesitate to do it all over again. Although I would quit. I'd quit a little sooner than I did because on those glacier flights down there, I know not only ran out of my own luck, but all my friends' luck and about 10,000 other people's luck, Ruth, the years I spent landing in those glaciers.
And reading about your dad's story, there were frequent crashes, engine failures, snowshoe trips to find refuge after his plane was disabled. How dangerous was this kind of work?
I don't think he really thought it was dangerous. Or he did have all the engine failures and occasionally went through crevices on the glaciers into the in the ice fields, but to hear him tell it, after living with him, I heard the story many times, was that, he had to make a living. And he didn't have any competition when he was doing that type of flying. So it was pretty unique. He'd say it was more unique, I think, than dangerous, although it was clearly dangerous.
As we wrap up, how do you see your father inspiring your own choices in your life?
The main thing I learned from him was to respect others. And, I think that's guided me more than anything else. As far as the aviation goes, I mean, I think it's in our blood. And, I was very fortunate to be fully employed in the aviation industry for my entire career, topping it off by being at Midwest Express, which to me was the highlight of my career. He was set a good example. I mean, he was a tough guy. He had to be tough to survive the things he went through. And I think I learned that resilience and never quit type of attitude. Do it right the first time. I followed his example, and I was very privileged, I'll say, to be a part of that family.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you, Rob.
David Reeve is the former CEO of Milwaukee-based Skyway Airlines and former senior vice president of Midwest Airlines. We talked to him about his father, the legendary Wisconsin bush pilot Robert Campbell Bob Reeve, who pioneered the practice of glacier flying in Alaska. Honeybees face deadly threats like insecticides and climate change. They pollinate an estimated $30 billion worth of crops across the country each year.
In the coming days, we'll check in with a Wisconsin entomologist to learn about how these vital pollinators are managing here in our state and concerns about their habitat.
If you are a beekeeper involved in raising colonies, we want to hear from you. What are you noticing? What are you noticing with your bees? Are they healthy? Have you seen recent die-offs? What do you chalk that up to? And what do you notice about the number of wild bees that come to your garden?
Reach out to us. Email wisconsintoday at WPR.org, or you can send a text to us or leave us a voicemail. The number is 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Avery Lee Rogers, Trevor Hook, and Beatrice Lawrence.
Our technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Sarah Hopeful.
The managing producer is Tim Peterson. Our executive producer is Dean Knetter.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.